Welcome to the Med Device Cyber Podcast, the podcast that dives into the critical world of medical device cybersecurity. I'm your host, Christian Espinoza, joined by my colleague, Trevor Slattery. Each week, we explore the latest trends, share expert insights, and discuss real-life stories that highlight the importance of protecting the devices we trust with our health. Whether you're a manufacturer, regulatory affairs professional, or a concerned loved one, this podcast is for you. Let's get started. Welcome to the Med Device Cyber Podcast. Today we have a guest, Steve. Steve's been in the industry quite a while, and he brings some valuable insights in it to help startups through their journey to get their device to market. You want to introduce yourself a little bit, Steve?
Yeah, sure. Firstly, thank you for having me on. So it's a real pleasure to be here. Yes, my name's Steve Bell, and for those that don't know me, you'll know that I wear purple. If you ever see me on LinkedIn, that's how you can find me. I've been in med device for just over 35 years, and I started my career at Johnson & Johnson, did 16 years there, did the whole transition from open surgery to laparoscopic, so have a lot of fondness for that whole minimally invasive side of things. Then I did a cardiovascular division within J&J, a women's health division, and I was actually part of the team that was looking at Intuitive back in the very early days when they were just getting going. I then left J&J and I did the California startup thing. So I used to commute between Rome and Los Angeles every 2 weeks. Did that for almost 10 years, which was interesting.
Gotta be exhausting.
Yeah, it was. You kind of get used to it, though. You get into the 405 was actually worse. Going down from Los Angeles to Irvine was worse than the transatlantic, which was quite bonkers, really. It took me longer sometimes to get down the 405. So I did multiple like hardcore startups, you know, where literally me and like Brad Sharp started some of the industry companies that we did in a cupboard, in a small cupboard, literally. One of the startups called Insitra that we did there. Did that for a long time, did a couple of turnaround companies, and then I sort of retired, crashed and burned a few startups, quite spectacular, which is where you get the most learning. But did well in a few, flipped a few. And then I was contacted by a really good guy called Martin Frost, who is the CEO of CMR Surgical, which is a soft tissue surgical robotic company. And Martin twisted my arm, and I went there for 6 months to basically go and set them up a commercial team, and ended up being there 6 years. And then said, okay, I think that's long enough now. And then last September, I stepped out. And since then, I'm sort of semi-retired, but trying to help the industry, you know, surgeons, young entrepreneurs, startup engineers, to really try and learn all the mistakes that, you know, I've made and a lot of my friends make in startups, so they don't make the same mistakes. So I'm doing a lot of that really at the minute, is trying to help startups to start up the right way.
Yeah, awesome. I call that the dumb tax. When my first cybersecurity company, I paid a lot of the dumb tax, as they say, and hopefully I pay less of it this time. You know, there's always a little bit of tax we have to pay. So that's great what you're doing. I hope you're helping people avoid some of that dumb tax, you know.
And in med tech startups, that's a really expensive dumb tax. I mean, it can literally, you know, sink your company. You know, a small decision like, you know, putting the company in the wrong place can easily derail your company and make it hard to raise follow-on rounds. So I have a website called howtostartupinmedtech.com. Tried to keep it easy. There's like 100 video online course that people can take, and it's basically just me blethering on for a good long while in about 100 videos, trying to just tell people the mistakes not to make and try and give them some insights of what, you know, really helps with a medtech startup. That's what kind of I do most days.
Yeah, I've taken part of your course. I know you have this idea in there, like it's kind of go big or go home. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I need to be careful how I say this, because there are small ideas for small disease states or orphan disease states that are really noble and should be absolutely followed. But my course is really about how you build a medtech business. And unfortunately, what I've just realized is the investors really don't want to invest into anything where they can't get big returns. It's been clear to me that investors, whether they invest 1 million or 10 million, it's kind of the same work for them. It's the same diligence. It's the same risk for them. So they'd rather put 10 million in and get a bigger return over the long run. So I try to encourage people that if you're going to think of a long-term, rather than a non-profit company, if you're trying to make a for-profit company, you need to be in big ideas, big spaces where, you know, there's the potential to make 100 million in revenue by year 10, or it's very hard to get investors to get excited and, sad, but true.
Awesome. So you said 100 million by year 10. Is that kind of like the golden standard?
Yeah, it's kind of, if you look at the math on this, if you're not getting at least those kind of numbers, it's really hard to make the profit that you need to make and do the kind of growth that you need to make and be interesting. If you're not doing 100 million or the opportunity is not worth 100 million, you don't necessarily have to get there. Although I'll talk about exits in a minute. It's not that exciting for a strategic. You know, a strategic to have if you're a Johnson & Johnson or a Stryker or a Medtronic and you're trying to bolt on 10 million of extra sales onto your, multi-billion sales, it doesn't kind of move the dial. So it's hard to get people very excited. It's not impossible, but it seems to be that if it's a, 100 million, billion, 2 billion opportunity, they seem to get excited about that a lot more. And I get it, right? That's the nature of strategics and business. The interesting thing is as well, you have to sort of aim big. Most people don't realize that 85% of medical device startups will fail. And a lot of them fail because they never get to profit. So they're forever trying to raise money and they run out of that ability to do that sooner or later. And then the second thing is it's taking on average now, when I first started doing startups in sort of 2005, you could potentially file some IP, get some R&D prototypes made, and you could flip the idea on a very early stage to a strategic that wanted to bolster their portfolio. Then it became, we want to make sure that you've got some first in human. And then it became, now we want some regulatory clearances. Then it became, we want you to have got at least some commercial success. And now the strategics, in their risk aversion are sort of, not all the time, but most of the time now saying, we want to see good commercial traction. So that, for any company, takes between 10 and 15 years. So the average exit time now for a medtech startup is between 10 and 12 years, average. So, it's got to be a big opportunity if you're going to put 10 years of your life into it.
Yeah, that's a pretty big commitment. In terms of, we talk about cybersecurity on our podcast, in terms of cybersecurity, when do you first hear some of these startups even like consider the idea, or do they even think about it? Or is it like they're kind of forced to do it and they don't really want to do it? Like what is your perspective, or what's the lens you kind of see through with this?
Yeah, so There's kind of three groups that I see in there. So anyone who's done a complex product before, a connected product or a robotic product or something with some, some software in it, and they've kind of been through this pain. So they tend to earlier on, still not as early as sometimes they should, but earlier on, they kind of have it on their radar. When you have, surgeon founders or young engineers coming out of college, first-time founders coming out of there, it's very rare that they really pick up on into it until they get kind of late stage with a regulatory consultant who says, by the way, what have we done for cybersecurity? And that can often be, in some cases, I've seen it very close to when they're making submissions. And that's where I've often seen for a lot of these startups that the wheels start coming off, because it's not just, and we've talked about this before, and again, maybe Trevor might want to jump in on this. I think people think you can just bolt cybersecurity on kind of at the end and get over the regulatory hurdles. And my experience has been when it's a late add-on to the company, it never ends well. It either derails the product, makes the product really, really, a long time to get through regulatory because you've got to keep sort of like bootstrapping stuff together to get it through, or sometimes it's a complete redesign.
What I try to look at with that lens, and what I try to tell people when they say, when should we consider cybersecurity? It's at the requirements phase. So you have an idea, you say, we want to create this device. What does the device need to do? They're going to build out those functional requirements. For every single functional requirement, they need to have the non-functional requirements on what's happening in the back, and cybersecurity needs to be part of that. Like you said, a lot of manufacturers will just try to bolt it on at the last minute, and it never works out. It's always clunky. It often requires a redesign. It's far more expensive than planning it out and doing it right the first time. So ultimately, it does come down to, like you said, a matter of experience. A lot of manufacturers, this isn't their first time doing a device. They know what to expect, and so they try to build in cybersecurity. A lot of times, it'll be sort of a bootstrap startup, and they don't know what they're getting into. They create a product. It works great, and then it's just a security nightmare for them to manage. So that is the ideal point, getting in as early as possible from my lens. And if it's not possible to get in that early and try to get cybersecurity built in, oftentimes then it's a matter of how creative the solutions can become.
Yeah, I have a question on that for kind of both of you. From a nomenclature perspective, I'm not sure everyone knows like the difference between functional and non-functional requirements. So that's one for you, Trevor. And then also in the industry, there's a lot of phrases thrown around, Steve, like, there's like strategics, CROs, investors, you know, so I don't know everyone knows those terms either. So maybe, Trevor, you could explain the non-functional and functional, then we'll throw it over to Steve to get a little background on the other terms.
Definitely. A functional requirement is what something has to do. So if you look at your email, the functional requirements are you have to be able to send an email to someone else. You have to receive an email from someone else. You see what emails have been opened, what are unopened, which emails are starred. The non-functional requirements are, how are you addressing encryption on those communications in transit? How are you making sure you can only read your own emails? You can't read someone else's emails. It's something that doesn't directly interact with the user experience, but it's an important functionality, an important feature to build into a product.
On the medtech side, we're sadly acronym mad. It's actually
we are in cybersecurity too.
Yeah, I know. And to be fair, there's there's a colleague of mine called Mark Slack who's excellent, and he basically has said multiple times, you know, we need to remove acronyms because it's really hard, A, for people who join companies, and B, people are always scared to ask what does the acronym mean, and therefore you know they sit ignorant for a long time. And Mark pointed that out many times, and I think it's a good point. So you've got a lot of acronyms in there, like CRO, so clinical research organizations. This is an organization often external to the company, but sometimes inside the company, that's going to basically make sure that you follow the right clinical practices to make sure that your clinical studies are up to scratch and up to code. You can have things like QARA, which is quality assurance and regulatory assurance. And that's often where you'll get into a lot of the cyber requirements will be in those groups that are kind of dealing with it. You mentioned the word strategics, and I bandied that about a little bit. So you can think about strategics as sort of like the big blue chip companies. So the big corporations are considered the strategics in our industry. It actually is a different definition in some other industries. So your Johnson & Johnsons, your Medtronics, your Strikers, your Boston Scientifics, some of the big companies like that are considered strategics. And they're usually major companies that have multiple arms in different fields. Whereas a startup, there's a really broad definition on startup, by the way. You know, is it when you've got two people sat around an R&D table in, you know, with a foosball machine or something? Or is it, you know, when you're really still out there having sold 300 systems? You know, are you just a bigger startup? And that's those whole definitions that we don't really have a very good industry definition of a lot of these. You know, when do you become an SME, another acronym, small, medium enterprise? When do you become a scale-up? When you move from startup to scale-up?
An SME in our industry is subject matter expert. So yeah, that's very confusing.
exactly. So you know, there are lots and lots of acronyms, and I would encourage all startups, you have a chance to expunge that very early on. if you can, because I'm too old to get out of the habit now. But if you've got a startup, I would definitely make your documentation with as few acronyms as possible and try and write stuff out and make sure that people really understand so that you've got alignment across the company. It's one of the failings of the startup, communication. Communication is easy when you've got four people sat around a table. When you get to your first 100 employees, that's when startups, the wheels start to come off because the communication starts to break down. When communication breaks down, speed breaks down. When speed breaks down, that becomes a problem because I talk a lot to startups about burn. Burn is how fast you're burning through your money. So you raise 10 million. If you're spending a million a month, you've got 10 months of runway. So if you have poor communication and something gets done badly, you could lose a month. That can be 1/10 of your entire burn can be lost because of poor communication. And that comes back to what Trevor was saying about, you know, getting this in early in the requirement stage for cyber. If you spend, and maybe I'm underestimating it here, 3 months of remedial work at pre-going for your FDA or pre-going for MDR, and you have to spend 3 months sort of going over some stuff again, that can be the difference between survival and failure of a startup, because it may take you, you know, it may now take you 3 months of extension of burn and you get through your cash that you weren't expecting.
So how do we, I think we both face the same, a little bit of the same challenge. Startups often don't want to listen to you, you know, about what you know, and they don't want to listen to us. So how do we, or what do you suggest? Like, because I think both of us are very passionate about helping new innovations get to market to improve the quality of healthcare and for individuals. So what do you suggest? Like, if I'm a founder, a med tech founder, like you said, you sometimes a surgeon has a great idea. What is the best way for them to understand, like, really what it takes to get their product to market from not only a funding perspective and a communication perspective, but also a cybersecurity perspective? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I actually have some strong thoughts on it. So I believe that there's too much of a have-a-go hero mentality within our industry where people just, you know, I'm a really good surgeon, so how hard can it be to do a startup, right? That's one of the problems that we face. I mean, it's difficult to do a startup. It's really difficult to do a med tech startup. Really difficult. So the first thing I suggest to everyone is get education. You know, I've put a course on there. There's lots of other courses out there. Get educated. There's lots of good congresses. I mean, we met at LSI. You know, LSI is a sort of a really good congress where people can go and listen to former founders. They can go and listen to people who've done it before and made the mistakes. Learn from those mistakes. Those dumb errors, as you say, are very expensive. So I think there's just a lot of foundational education that people should go through before they put pen to paper or get the R&D people putting screws in things. I think there needs to be a lot more preparation and education. I think that will help a lot. And then the second thing is there are lots of experts in the industry who they can reach out to, either as mentors. There's lots of mentors out there. There's people who've done serial startups and crashed many of them, but also had successes. No reason you can't just ask them to give you some guidance. You know, part of the problem is that the people who do startups aren't usually the people who think they need help and need to go off and ask things. That's part of the double-edged sword of startup founders. But I would suggest people go out and just, you know, raid people's brains and try and get all the information they can. And then the second one is to go to industry experts. So, you know, hopefully people listening to this podcast are getting a bigger awareness of cyber. Well, they're not just going to go off and be able to Google it all, right? Why they don't come and speak to people like you? You know, so I encourage people to reach out to industry experts. There's a real problem with academia doing startups. So if you come out of the Oxford or the Cambridge or the Stanford, or you come out of one of these places, you've been a super high flyer your entire life. You've very rarely failed, otherwise you wouldn't have got all the way through that academia. And you also believe that how could anybody else have had a good idea before you? That's one of the really big challenges. So what they do is they often go back to first principles. and they try and do everything from first principles. So on cyber, you know, I know two companies where they said, we'll go and just work that out. We'll go and read the regs and we'll just go and work it out and we'll kind of do it ourselves. Because how could anyone else, how could you guys know more than they could? And that's one of the problems of the academic startup teams and models. People need to put the pride away a little bit, realize that there's a difference between intelligence and experience. That's a big, big difference between those two things.
And that's a problem with humanity, not just like...
Yeah, I know, I know. I know. But if we can get people to say, yeah, you can be intelligent, but also you can also ask for some experience, I think we'll shortcut a lot of things and we'll get a lot of better outcomes. And we won't end up with so much redoing and reinventing the wheel, then realizing that their wheel doesn't work, and then going and finding an expert to try and recover it, which is always harder and it's always messier and it's always worse when you try and do remedial action on something.
I agree. So Trevor, what do you think, like, if a med tech company, like when these startups that Steve is mentioning, because we hear this conversation quite a bit, they always say, well, we're not ready for cyber, right? But if they're just starting up and they're still looking at the requirements and design, from your perspective, Trevor, like, what would be the benefit of connecting with a company like us or having them start a cybersecurity at, you know, that early in the game?
I think there are three main things to look at. So the first is, of course, the money involved with it. You know, like you mentioned, Steve, money is really important for startups. And if you make mistakes, you can burn through your money really fast. Getting it right the first time on cybersecurity and building all of these cybersecurity requirements into your device is going to cost you far less money than having to go and do a band-aid fix on the back end. Second thing is time, which also ties into money. If you plan to submit in a month, realize, oh, we haven't done anything we need to do for cybersecurity, and you go in for your penetration test, you realize that you have 2 months of remediation to do, you've just pushed back your submission date and then your hopeful clearance by 2 full months. And that's a lot of downtime.
Yeah, and like Steve was mentioning, if your burn rate is like $1 million a month, that's $2 million you're behind schedule. Plus, you're not selling the product because it's not on the market either.
Exactly. So you're losing money on so many different fronts there. Another area is just how smooth the process can be. We've done it in the past where a company will come to us and say, hey, we need to submit in 30 days. We haven't even considered the word cybersecurity. It's a frustrating, stressful process, all hands on deck. The client has a lot of things to work through. We have to work overtime to make sure that everything's getting done, and it can happen. But it's never a good time for anyone, and it doesn't need to always be that stressful. The ideal situation is if someone comes to us early on and says, how can we incorporate security into our device? This is what we want our device to do. What do we need to consider? We can help them spot out the common pitfalls early on. So then once they have a device, they're ready for their required penetration testing, and it's smooth. They come back with 2 or 3 quick findings. So there are a whole bunch of different areas that can just be streamlined by this whole process without needing this constant back and forth and burning a whole bunch of extra money by pushing it into the last possible minute.
So I always talk about with some of the startups and the founders about design decisions and how a decision even a year and a half ago, when you get to clearance, trying to get through the FDA or MDR, can really have an impact from a cybersecurity perspective. Can you maybe speak to design decisions a little bit, Trevor?
There are a lot of things.
Maybe an example?
Yeah, a great example is Secure Boot. Secure Boot. So Secure Boot, essentially anytime you're starting up a device, make sure that nothing on the inside has been modified or tampered with. This is to prevent someone from going in and putting on some malicious software onto a device or replacing an application without it getting checked. That is, you need to build a device with Secure Boot in mind. You can't just slap it on at the end. It's not a little box you tick. You have to build it with that consideration start to finish. So there will be times where someone will come to us with a device and I'll ask them, do you have Secure Boot enabled? And they go, no, we don't. And we need to submit in a month. We can't redesign the entire product in a month. So then it becomes a lot more difficult to figure out how are we going to handle data integrity in this system where the features aren't built in. So that's something that people should think about from that design perspective. There can also be a lot of just inherently insecure functionalities. Oftentimes, we'll have a lot of back and forth with clients on, we want to have, a connection to the internet. And that can be great for a lot of reasons. You can do remote monitoring, updates, maintenance. You can make any changes from the cloud, but that means bad guys can see it from the internet too. So there are a lot of considerations, and oftentimes startups trying to get, just a product cleared, want to go down the path of an air gap device before they go down the path of bringing in that connectivity, which can often open up a whole bunch of can of worms for security considerations.
Can I ask a question there then? So, when we're building startups, you're always stuck for headcount. Of course, you're always stuck for headcount, right? But there's also fractionals. There's a possibility to have fractionals. I've not seen many startups that have a cyber head, somebody responsible for cybersecurity early on in the company. I think you don't see it till real later on. It's usually one of the IT team, or it's one of the engineers, one of the software engineers gets sort of pinned and tagged with it. But are there individuals out there that startups could go and employ? If you've got a robot or something that you know is going to be connected with extreme connectability, and even telerobotics, for example, do those people exist out there?
There are going to be two different people that you have to bridge that gap. So it's not just a focus on the pure cybersecurity considerations. It's a focus on the regulatory considerations. You have to be able to meet all of the FDA requirements. You have to meet all of the requirements for risk management through ISO 14971 and TIR 57. So it's not just a one simple solution. Oftentimes it works to have someone who specializes in regulatory and knows the cybersecurity side at a high enough level, and then someone who specializes in cybersecurity and knows the regulatory side at a high enough level. I would say there are some people out there who can cover both areas, but definitely a little bit more of a unique case. So cybersecurity and regulatory are very connected industries, but they're so separate and so distinct with the execution, it often helps to have both involved.
I think from our experience, there's a gap. The gap is most companies, and this even includes like really massive companies with like 6,000 employees or over 6,000, they try to make their IT cybersecurity people, like their CISO or people that know cybersecurity traditionally, in charge of product cybersecurity. And the lens is very different. A medical device has very different cybersecurity requirements than an enterprise. But most people don't realize that. So they say, oh, this is a cybersecurity person. Everyone thinks if you're cybersecurity, you know everything cyber. So they put you in charge of the product. And that typically doesn't work from our experience. So a better approach, which you were alluding to, is like consulting with experts. Like we have a couple of companies we're working with now they haven't even started coding the device, and they're working with us so we can consult them about the requirements, those non-functional requirements that Trevor was talking about, so they can do it right from the beginning and make sure they have a more solid roadmap. And I think this also helps with investors. If you're looking to get your device to market and get another round of investing, if you have a well thought out roadmap and you've considered cybersecurity, that's going to put you ahead of other people pitching the investor. Because I think investors now are realizing a lot of companies forgot about cybersecurity and their investments are being not looking as good as they thought they would because of the delays.
It was funny you should say that. So I am seeing, and it's really in the last 18 months, 24 months, that the due diligence packs never used to involve the cyber. They didn't, it would have your commercial plan, your QA plan, your roadmap through regulatory, your clinical plan. Now more and more I can see startups are being asked about, what's your cyber plan? What's your cybersecurity plan? How are you going to make sure that you're a connected device? Because the investors have also understood that, yes, air gap devices are interesting, but it's not the exciting piece. They want, they sort of kind of always say that the data is the new gold, right? They kind of say that all the time. I'm not sure they quite understand what they mean by that, and I don't understand quite who's going to make all this money off it. But if they've got that in their minds, they're going to also want to make sure that's protected both ways. They want to make sure there's no harm to patients done. They want to make sure, if this thing is connected to the internet somehow. People can't get into it or different ways and harm patients, because that is a pretty short ride for a company if you get that kind of press early on. And then the second thing they want to do is they want to protect their data. You know, they are terrified of bad actors around the world scooping up either data from the company is one side of it, but they're really concerned about all those insights coming off, like from smart robots, for example, that all that data, which is really valuable to get insights and to do, you know, a lot of training models for AI and stuff. They're very scared that people might siphon a lot of that off. So, yeah, I think that investors now are getting wise to it. Still not quite there yet. Maybe that's something you can do, which is go and, you know, educate the investors of the right questions to ask in due diligence. Maybe that will get people earlier on, because they'll be told in your use of proceeds, we want to see, you know, X thousand, X hundred thousands put against cyber. But yeah, investors are definitely waking up to this and understanding that in the new generation of what myself and Joe Mullings are calling more, you know, tech med rather than med tech. As we get into the tech med side of things a lot more, the investors are starting to understand that it has to be protected.
Yeah, that's a good angle. I think the investors need to be educated as well, because they obviously want a return on their investment and they need to manage the risk. So cybersecurity, it's refreshing to hear you say it's becoming something that the investors look at from a criteria perspective. So as we wrap up here, Steve, like, not to put you on the spot, but what would you say the top three things are? Like, if I'm a med tech startup, like, what are the, you always allude to that med tech is harder than starting up in another industry. Like, what are the top three things I should be concerned about?
Yeah. So the first and hardest thing for founders, and they think it's all about the idea, and they don't realize that if you're the founder or you're the CEO, you have one job in life. Raise money. Okay. And that is a continuous thing that goes on.
That doesn't sound
forever.
As exciting as bringing my innovation to life, though.
it doesn't. But unfortunately, if you've got no money, you've got no company, you've got no business, you've got no exit. So the first thing is the big watch out is learn how to raise money properly. You know, make sure that you really know how to pitch properly, how to prepare your messaging properly, how to things like data rooms. You know, people are notoriously bad at data rooms. They send Excel files around for diligence. It's quite incredible. So that's one of the things they've got to learn. I think the second thing is, as well, is you've got to look that the pyramid is upside down to how people think. They think it's all R&D, and then you do the commercial on top of that. It's the opposite way around. R&D and the whole R&D of it is less than 10% of the actual venture. The majority of it, and the hardest part of it, is commercialization. There's thousands and thousands of single prototypes that sort of crawl across the line and become a minimal viable product. Very few of those, unless they're commercialized properly, ever actually become a success. And that's why, again, why the strategics are very good, because they do know how to commercialize. But I think startups, the big watch out for them should be early on, they should know the end game of commercialization before they put a single screw into anything. Because a little bit like cyber, you know, bolting on at the end pricing, when, you know, you say, you know, we make this thing for $100, therefore we need to sell it for $200. And the customer says, well, we only have $50 to pay for it. There's a big disconnect because they've not understood the commercial end point before they get to building the screws. And again, a good R&D team, if early on you say to them, your sandbox is this, you can't make this for more than $25, they'll tell you all the features they can't put into it, but you'll have a product that at least you can sell commercially. So that's another one of the big watch outs. And then the other one is regulatory, and it is linked to the cyber a lot, but it's the regulatory in general. People are massively overambitious of when they think they're going to get something through the regulatory pathway. The regulatory has got harder and harder. You know, MDR has become notoriously bad and hard. But any of that, if you get the right experts, you know, talk about the cyber again, if you get your cyber sorted earlier on, you don't have that 3-month extension, you get, you know, your clinicals done in the right way, your lab practice done in the right way, your validation and verification done in the right way, in the right formats that the regulatory bodies like, you know, don't try and reinvent the wheel again. And again, using good regulatory experts who've done this before will give you much better timelines and costs of it.
Yeah, awesome. Those are some good pearls of wisdom, Steve. I think starting with the end in mind is always important for anything. And I like your sandbox analogy. Tell them $25 all you have to make this product, so therefore we can sell and make a profit. I don't think a lot of people think of it through that lens. So what's a good way for people to get a hold of you, Steve?
Okay, so the easiest way to get hold of me, besides being on LinkedIn, they can find me as Steve Bell on LinkedIn. But if they're interested in startups and trying to get some knowledge on startups, and also find a list of partners in there who can give them that kind of advice, then they can go to howtostartupinmedtech.com, which has got an H on the end, so medtech with an H on the end, .com. And they can get all the information there, and all my contact details are there, or reach out to me on LinkedIn.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks for being a guest on our podcast. And we appreciate you sharing some of your wisdom for the journey over your 35 years of wisdom, basically. So people can avoid paying that dumb tax. I only have like 30 years experience in cybersecurity.
Look, awesome. Guys, thank you very much. And again, really enjoyed being on the podcast. And why it's exciting for me as well is because I don't get to talk about this stuff enough. I always get to talk about some of the other stuff on MedTech. But I think this is kind of one of the hot topics at the minute, so it's a pleasure to talk about it.
All right, awesome. Well, thanks again.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Med Device Cyber Podcast. We hope you gain valuable insights into the world of medical device cybersecurity. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Should cybersecurity be top of mind for your medical device company and you wish to learn more about how Blue Goat Cyber can help your business, please click on the link in the show notes below to book a discovery call with our team. Stay informed and empowered to protect yourself and the people your company serves. Until next time, stay safe and secure.